Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Jake and Stacy is presented exclusively by CarPro's Kia Tacoma. It was a gutting loss for the Mariners last night to the Red Sox. Here to talk about their chances moving forward is Larry Stone of the Seattle Times, joining us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Stacy. Hey, Jake.
It was a collectively like 8 hours of baseball in the last two games, something like that. Really long games in this series. And it was obviously really tough to sit through it in both instances for fans and then see a loss on the other side. So I'll start with the really obvious question at the forefront of a lot of fans' minds, which is, Larry, what are the chances the Mariners can still get this done?
So you're saying there's a chance.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Well, it's not completely hopeless. They're four out with 16 to play. What makes it difficult is they're chasing four teams for two spots. So they're going to need some collapses, as Ryan Tivish wrote today. They're going to need some teams to throw up on themselves. That was his colorful term. And they're going to have to go minimum, I think, 13-3, maybe even 14-2, I think, to get it done. You know, teams have run off streaks like that. The Mariners haven't had a streak like that this year. Maybe it's in them. They've surprised us before this year, but those were just killer losses the last 2 days. And then you go back to the Diamondbacks series, losing two of three at home. That was killer as well. A 2-4 homestand, you reverse that, and they're in pretty good shape, 4-2. And then you go back to the 3 out of 4 they lost to Kansas City. You know, just opportunities they had against some bad teams to make up some ground and really put themselves in a good position. They just didn't do it. So it does not look good, not at all.
All right, Larry, 13-3, 14-2. Sounds doable. I think we can make it happen. Larry, after this situation, when this series, I put it out there on Twitter during the game, it just felt like youth and inexperience just reared its ugly head in this matchup. When you talk about legitimate playoff baseball and playoff caliber baseball, what stood out to you the most over these two games in this series that they ended up losing?
Well, yeah, squandered opportunities was one thing. The game 2 nights ago where they had some chances early to break the game open, bases loaded, no outs, and I think they got 2 runs out of it. They could have gotten a lot more, a few situations like that. And the bullpen, the other thing that stood out, Jake, was the bullpen kind of hitting a wall, the bullpen which has really kind of carried them this year. I don't know what the exact stat was. I remember seeing it in a graphic, the comparison to the Red Sox bullpen and the Mariners bullpen in that series. I think.
Yeah, I took a picture of it, Larry. Just to refresh your mind, 11 innings, 14 hits, 12 earned runs, 15 strikeouts with 5 walks.
Yeah, well, but a lot of that was in two innings late in each. You know, the eighth inning on Tuesday, and then the 10th inning last night led to a lot of that. But, you know, in both those games, if they had had some timely hitting, it wouldn't have gotten that far. It would have been a different story. That Kelnick at bat last night was just brutal, where it just practically kicking up chalk down the right field line. If that had been fair, with the runner was running on the pitch, Bowers, he would have scored. Kelnick would have been the hero. And instead, you know, he strikes out, and that's just about it. So, yeah, you know, you're right. A lot of youth and inexperience came to the front, and a lack of timely hitting and the bullpen.
Yeah, brutal luck with that pitch, too, that final pitch being a changeup and being his second something like that of the season. I mean, if you're Kelnick, you probably do everything. Most people would do everything just how he did it. And instead, you know, he's getting, you know, some flack for what's been a tough stretch, but I don't put that one on him. It was close.
Well, I don't put it on him,
yeah.
But it's just so many chances that he's had to be the hero. And, you know, he looks competitive in some of these at-bats, but so often it just ends up with a strikeout. It's just frustrating from his standpoint.
Speaking of these young players, and Kelnick, one of them, and including Julio in this conversation, talking about the young core moving forward, I think many fans are hoping the Mariners go out and spend. How do you, how do you hypothetically balance wanting to bring in stars that can help you next year if you want to contend while not blocking the path for any of the young stars you're going to have?
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, you do have to go out and spend this offseason. And I think the Lewis situation, you just don't know what he's going to be. How much he's going to be able to play in the outfield next year with that knee problem. I think last year you probably were looking at a Kelnick, Julio, Kyle Lewis outfield with no need to go get another outfielder, but I don't think that's materialized. And I do think that you need to go out and get maybe a pure center fielder next year, because that's a Kelnick. I just don't think he's a center fielder. He'd be much better in the corners. So, I don't think that's really an issue to me. I think you need to go out and fill the outfield. Who knows what the situation is going to be with Haniger? He's going into the last year of his contract. I would think they'd bring him back, but you never know. There's a spot in the infield for a bat. Either you could put him at third or at second. I wouldn't mess with J.P. Crawford at shortstop. I think he's earned the right to. He's probably the best defensive shortstop in the league. So, and his offense is steadily improving. I think you go out and get one more bat, and that would sort of dictate where you put Toro, France, etc. I don't expect Seager to be back, to be honest.
So Larry, that was going to be my question when you mentioned that opening. That is assuming that Kyle Seager will not be back. And, you know, everybody's rightly pointing out the club option right now, because he hit the incentives and it makes it escalate all the way to $20 million. They're not going to pay that, of course. But so you don't see them trying to renegotiate, come back to the table, and potentially work out a deal with Kyle Seager in the future?
I would be surprised. It's not out of the realm of possibility. You can make arguments both ways. It's going to be hard to replace 35 homers and 100 RBIs, that's for sure, and the defense and the leadership. If it was my decision, I would bring him back. But reading the tea leaves, I just don't see it happening. There's another hole you got to fill. This is a team that didn't hit much this year. That was probably their Achilles heel, among many, you know, other weaknesses, is that they're one of the worst offensive teams in the league. So, and then to take 35 homers and 100 RBIs off of that is difficult. But I just have a sense that it's kind of reached the end of the line with Seager here and the money and all that. So,
yeah,
that's going to be something to watch. That's going to be the most important decision, you know, along with Kikuchi, that we'll get right away, really, because you got to make those decisions on the options right after the World Series.
Yeah, there'll definitely be a domino effect that will occur here. There's no question about that. Off of those moves, Larry. And the thing that becomes so increasingly difficult for this group is the fact that the expectations are changing. They've also stated that themselves, that they're going to get active. But also, you have all this talent in your farm system. You have Julio Rodriguez that's going to come up next year. They've talked so glowingly about George Kirby and Matt Brash and these young pitchers that they have, that I presume will be up at some point next year. How do you add, and I know I'm asking you the million-dollar question here, Larry, but I want to get your perspective on this, is how do you add around this and still continue to keep bringing up some of those guys through your farm system where they become competitive and not the same song and dance that we heard this last year about, oh, well, it's development. We got to get these guys developed.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's tricky. And what makes it even trickier is the fact that these guys are not racking up innings. They've been very cautious with them, coming off a year in which most of them didn't pitch in games at all. You look at the innings for Hancock and Kirby, they're 50, 60 innings this year, which means they're not going to be in a position to just go right into a rotation next year. I think at some point they'll be up, but they're going to have to soft pedal that again next year. You don't, you know, there's studies that show what leads to arm problems is big jumps in innings. So it's going to have to be more of a gradual thing. So even though those guys will be a part of it at some point, you still need some established guys to hold down the rotation. You know, I don't think Kikuchi's another one that's looking like, unless Kikuchi decides to exercise his one-year option, I don't think the Mariners are going to exercise their four-year option. So, you know, that spot will be available for somebody, and, the Anderson spot. So there will be a couple of spots in the rotation. So I think you could still go out and sign a veteran innings eater type guy and not have it really hurt, stop the development or block the guys that you mentioned.
What do you do with Kyle Lewis then if you don't have him in center field? I mean, is he a guy that you keep because he's just, you know, you hope and lean on his bat? Is he a guy that, you know, you trade? I mean, what do you anticipate the team doing?
Yeah, that's another huge question. I think you give him a shot at center field, you know, see how his knee is reacting over this offseason. But I think I don't think you can play him there every day. You know, maybe you rotate him to the corner, to DH or something like that, play him in center field a couple times a week. I just don't think he could be an everyday center fielder unless there's this miraculous improvement in his knees. But I do think he's a guy that you want to keep around because his potential is so great and he's such a talent that he's a good guy to have on the team.
Yeah, there's no doubt, and it will be fascinating to see how that ends up playing out, Larry. But the last question I have for you is there any player that you look at right now, because we talk about the farm system, talk about some of the players, are there any players or farm system pieces that they could end up using as trade chips to go and get somebody, to go and get a big-name player that we're not thinking of? Is there any candidates that stand out to you?
Yeah, you know, and I think that might be the route that they have to go because, let's be honest, it's hard to get free agents to come to Seattle for a variety of reasons. And so you may have to go to the trade route. And, you know, I don't know specific names, but they have the reason you build a farm system that's got depth and is ranked number one in Baseball America is not just to have them on your major league team. It's to use to get as to have the depth to use them to get trade trade to have as trade bait. So I do think that they have a really deep core of pitchers in the minor leagues, and I don't know which ones they trade, but. You know, I would not be at all surprised if they dip into that inventory and trade one of those guys from, you know, Kirby, Hancock, Brash, Williamson, one of those guys that Juan Fenn. They've got so many guys that that are on the brink of making it to the majors and are really highly touted that you may end up using that to get, a power hitting outfielder or a third baseman or something like that.
He's Larry Stone. You can read his work at the Seattle Times, seattletimes.com/sports. That's where I automatically go to check it out. Larry, we always love when you join us. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks.
See ya. All right, it is time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru, Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
All right, first down, Jake. What are the two key matchups that will determine the outcome of Sunday's Seahawks game against the Titans?
Going to go with one on each side of the ball. On the offensive side of the ball, it is going to be these Seahawks skill players against the Tennessee secondary. What I saw on film, the Tennessee secondary really, really struggled to match up with DeAndre Hopkins, with Christian Kirk, with A.J. Green, with their entire skill group that they had out there with the Cardinals. So I believe that the Seahawks have an even better crop of skill players than what Arizona brought to the table. And so the key matchup to me is whether or not the Seahawks skill players can feast, the passing game can feast on this Tennessee passing game that has really struggled, not just in week one of the season this year, but also all of last season as well. So that to me will be the key on the offensive side of the ball. Then I look at the defensive side of the ball, and it is going to be about the trenches. It is all about the trenches in this game for the Seattle Seahawks defense. Pass rush and run-stopping ability. You cannot let Derrick Henry become an active participant in this game and allow him to take over. You cannot give him free running lanes. You have to clog that thing. You have to make it difficult on Derrick Henry and wrap up and tackle. You got to bring your big boy pads to come wrap up Derrick Henry this week. If you can control the line of scrimmage, if you can generate pressure on Ryan Tannehill, this could be another comfortable lead, a comfortable game for the Seattle Seahawks. Two in a row, Stacey? I don't think Seahawks fans would know what to do with themselves. It may be too much to ask, but that to me is going to be the key. If the defensive line can dominate and control the game on Sunday, this is going to be a very, very favorable game for the Seahawks.
Second down. Jake, you think Seahawks fans should be excited about what the offense can do against Tennessee's defense, and you have a very specific reason. So what style of defense do the Titans play?
The Tennessee Titans, they like to play a lot of man coverage. Now, one of the other unique aspects about it is that the Philadelphia Eagles defensive coordinator, former defensive coordinator Jim Schwartz, who DK Metcalf was not happy with.
Never forget.
Pre-game, trying to give him a compliment about how he compares to Calvin Johnson, and DK took it as a slight. He is actually a senior defensive analyst with the Tennessee Titans. So you know that there's going to be some of that same flavor of style of defense, which means there's going to be a lot of man-to-man coverage. And giving DK Metcalf, giving Tyler Lockett, giving Gerald Everett, this group, man-to-man coverage, I'm really, really excited to see what the Seahawks offense can do with that, and I believe that they'll do extremely well. So when they get man-to-man, they have to capitalize. They have to make the Tennessee Titans pay because they have the personnel to do it.
Third down. Jake, what do the Huskies have to do against Arkansas State to right this ship?
Oh, I mean, to right the ship, I mean, you look at what the Huskies have really struggled with overall. I mean, it has been the ground game, Arkansas State, they don't really run the ball very much.
No, they
throw it all over the yard. And so for the Huskies defense, they've got to prove that they've got one of the best passing defenses in the country. That's what they've touted. Now they got to go prove that. They also touted that they had one of the greatest running games in the country. They had one of the more dominant offensive lines in college football. That didn't come true. So that needs to be shown by Jimmy Lake, by this defense. And Arkansas State gives up a lot of points. So for an offense that's been so anemic, just absolutely putrid, you have to show that you can actually put the ball in the end zone against one of the weaker defenses in all of college football. And if you can't do that, if you can't adequately put points up on the board against this defense,
as Scott Service would say,
I mean,
shame on you.
Shame on you. Absolute shame on you. All the ire of Husky Nation right now, if you can't do that, I mean, it's just the beginning of what we've seen so far.
Shame on you.
Shame on you.
Thank you, Scott.
Fourth down. Jake, from what you've seen so far, what has offensive coordinator Shane Waldron brought to Seattle that will make the Seahawks better?
Well, we had Danny Kelly on from The Ringer and on yesterday with us, and he talked about the deception, the use of pre-snap motion and what it does to defenses here in cut number 13.
So like a thinking defense is a slower defense. Instead of just coming at you full bore as a defensive end, you have to kind of like think and react and wonder what they're doing. So I put together just like clip of mashup of all the different plays the Seahawks had motion on Sunday. And on a lot of the plays, it's like you can't even quickly tell right away where the ball is. And I think that's the main point, right? It's just making it more difficult for the defense. They have to think. They're slower to react.
And so that ability to gain that step, to make the defense think, that creates big plays. Big plays out of small plays, right? And so that is a crucial, unique thing that is from this Shanahan coaching tree, particularly with Sean McVay himself, is when you create that deception pre-snap, there is purpose to it. It's not just motioning a guy to motion a guy. it is setting things up in the run game, in the play action game, in the screen game, in the fly sweep game. So overall, it's just well thought out. And it, what it does is it gives an already talented, elite talented group on offense an extra edge.
Mm-hmm.
And when you give them that extra edge, that makes them so dangerous. And that's why I have such high hopes that this offense can truly be one of the best offenses in the NFL and do it all season long. And if they can do that, Stacey, they will be in the hunt for the Super Bowl.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. You can subscribe to the Jake and Stacey podcast, by the way, wherever you get your podcasts. If you're not a big podcast person, that's okay. You can listen to the show on 710sports.com, or you can also watch the live stream on 710sports.com/video. As a reminder, we have a short show today because the huddle, the world famous huddle, is on at noon. Dave Wyman is going to join us. We're going to preview. It's a 2-hour preview of week 2 for the Seahawks, and we're going to have 2 Seahawks guests, including tight end Will Dissly and safety Ryan Neal. Very exciting. Before any of that, though, a favorite candidate for the USC head coaching gig was asked point blank whether he's interested. He had a very testy reaction. You'll hear it next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey,
brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
Jake and Stacey is presented exclusively by CarPros Kia Tacoma. This is The Timeline when we tell you the stories you may have missed trending on your own timeline, fill you in about what's going on in the world of sports today. So it's basically a look around. And let's start somewhat locally in the Pacific Northwest. Oregon head coach Mario Cristobal is a favorite candidate that's been linked to the open USC head coaching gig, obviously given his success at Oregon, given his status already in the Pac-12, and given the perception from outside the Pac-12 that USC is the best job in the world and the only school worthy of any attention in the Pac-12, but I'm not salty about it. He got testy with Fox Sports' Doug Gottlieb when asked about possibly having interest in the USC job. Cut 10.
When people mention your name for said job, what would your response be?
My response is go Ducks.
Any chance that you at least have a conversation about it?
Telling you again, go Ducks. I'm not sure why you brought me on this interview. I was talking about the Oregon Ducks and whatnot. Since we go this route, I'll reinforce it again. Go Ducks. And so here I am, buddy.
Now, I actually hadn't heard that cut before. I knew that he had just said go Ducks in the interview, but starting with, I'm not really sure why you brought me on this interview, if this is where the conversation was going to go, made me cringe, like, just uncomfortably so.
Good for him.
Yeah.
I mean,
not on his part. I mean, for the part of an interviewer
Gottlieb's got a job to do, but, I mean, at the same time, you know, if you're a head coach in this situation, like, you don't want to be asked about this.
Mm-hmm.
And for Cristobal, you know what you also gave a perfect answer to? Is if you're considering taking the USC job, that's a great answer to have. Go Ducks. And honestly, I think that that's what more head coaches should do. Don't promise anything. Don't promise that you are not going to take a job. You don't know what the offer is going to be. What if Cristobal genuinely believes that he is going to stay and remain the head coach at Oregon and USC comes into town and says, you know what, we're going to give you an offer. We're going to give you an offer you can't refuse, right? And they're going to pay him a boatload of money and he would be foolish to not take that job, right? Like, why would you put yourself in that position? You just look like the bad guy. So ultimately, I think that he gave the right answer. But with Cristobal, you're coming off this huge win. You're trying to promote Oregon. You're trying to promote what you're doing with your program. And you got somebody asking you about this job and not just asking you one time, but trying to grill you on it. Trying to, I know, coach, you gave me the answer, but like, tell me really, really, what is your answer? Like, no, I'm not going to give you that. You kidding me?
It is one of those weird things, though, where both of them have jobs to do. Like, I don't blame Gottlieb. Everyone wants to make, like, an interviewer a villain. But, like, he's also being told, like, you have this guy on. This is the question people want to know.
Yeah.
And they might hate you for asking it and be like, oh, so tactless. But they want to know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they want to know whether he's going to do it.
You put that, it's like you put your hand on the hot plate and no wonder you're going to get burned. So if you go for it, go for it.
Yeah.
Don't regret it because that's the answer that you're going to get. You're going to get a testy head coach that doesn't want to give you the answer you're looking for.
We had Bruce Feldman on the other day who not only kind of shot down that he thinks Chris Peterson would take that job, didn't think that that would be something he'd be interested in. Obviously, you can't predict, but he said he'd be really surprised by that. And he knows Chris Peterson well. We didn't press too much on Mario Cristobal. My assumption has been that he's going to be fine with Oregon. He's happy with Oregon. It's a great school. Recruiting is easy with the obviously Phil Knight and with their facilities, with all of this stuff, with how competitive they've been in the conference. Do either of you actually see him taking this job?
No, I don't see Cristobal taking this job because I do think at Oregon right now, what he has built is really, really good. And you're going to have to start from the ground up at SC again. And quite frankly, I mean, at Oregon, you have all the resources you need. Like, you really do. You have all the resources you need to be successful. And if you can make Oregon into a juggernaut, well, guess what? Any of the SEC teams, any of the, you know, teams that can provide even more, are going to come calling. And I believe Cristobal would be more interested in a top flight program in the SEC than he would be about USC. So I think he's in a pretty good spot right now.
All right. Really cool news today from Milwaukee. The Bucks made Lisa Byington the team's TV play-by-play voice. She becomes the first woman to hold that title for a major U.S. men's pro sports team. And by the way, I've already seen comments from people saying, why is this news? Why does it matter if she can do the job? The answer is representation matters, and that hearing, obviously important, seeing a woman get this role, I think matters for a lot of people, especially young girls, to be able to grow up thinking of the jobs they want. I don't think it's a coincidence, for instance, that when I was growing up, a lot of the jobs that I thought I wanted were jobs that I never thought sports. Like, I never thought sports ever at all.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was growing up, it was like, I wanted to be a teacher. Then I wanted to be a waitress. Then I wanted to be a singer, model, actress.
Of course.
Then I wanted to
dinosaur
be...
dinosaur.
Yeah.
Lion.
Then I wanted to be an archaeologist. I don't know where that one came from. But those were the jobs I wanted when I was little. I think that seeing representation and diversity, not just with gender, but just all across the board, matters. And I know people will be mad and they'll be like, for the sake of diversity... Yeah, lots of different voices are important. And I also think it's really important for young people to see possibilities that they might not be thinking about. So, well, I think this is cool news.
No, it is cool news. I think it's awesome. And to me, as you look at it and you bring it up from that perspective of just seeing somebody in that being a possibility, I think it's really cool. And having that moment, it's great. And, you know, I think for Lisa, you talk about this 20 years ago, there's no way she even is considered for this role or for that job or for that opportunity. So good for her. That's awesome. And so I think that when you're talking about just breaking the barriers, I think that's great. And the other part of it, too, is I don't think this is it gets lost in the shuffle of representation and all these other political topics of conversation, more so than, are you the right person for the job? And people that have been good for the job have not gotten those opportunities or even gotten an interview or gotten their foot in the door because they didn't fit the mold of what was the standard. So that, to me, is what is cool and what's exciting.
And it's the Milwaukee Bucks, one of the most visible franchises in the NBA and one of the most visible franchises in the world now. I mean, they're the defending NBA champions. They've got Giannis, who's a global superstar. This is going to be one of the biggest platforms of anybody in the entire league.
Yeah, I think all of it matters. All of it's important. And congratulations to Lisa. I think this is such an amazing thing to see. I might be tuning in for some more Bucks games. Who knows? Okay, from exciting news to heartbreaking news. Going to end with this one because, Jake, I want you to get the final word here. Trevor Moad passed away last night due to complications from cancer. He was a mental health conditioning coach for lots of people. I mean, working all over the board, but the sports community in multiple cities, multiple athletes hit hard this morning with this news. Trevor had been privately battling with cancer for the past 2 years. It sounds like not many people knew about it at all. Jake, you were one of the people that knew Trevor, and I know this news hit you hard this morning, so don't want to put you too much on the spot, but
yeah.
I mean, how are you feeling right now, and how's the community around Trevor feeling?
Well, it's hard. It's a really hard day, to be honest with you, and I found out as I was just walking into the building. And Trevor, I didn't know he had cancer. I didn't know he was battling with it. I should have seen the signs in terms of how he was managing and dealing with COVID. But him and I, great friends, you know, talked all the time. I talked to him 3 weeks ago. We're joking about getting him on the show during the season, and and all these things. And it's just, it doesn't surprise me that Trevor wouldn't tell anybody. He is incredibly selfless, wouldn't want any pity, probably had an incredible attitude and perspective. At least it sounded like it from all the conversations we had. But I will greatly miss him. I'll greatly miss our conversations. And quite frankly, I wish we could have just one more. So he'll be missed, but his legacy will live on, and his legacy will live strong, because Trevor changed the game when it came to sports performance, coaching. He approached it in a way that was so different from everyone else. This was not a therapist. This was not somebody that just kind of talked in grandiose ways. He talked in a way that resonated with athletes. He talked in a way that was very bullish in a lot of ways and very to the point. And it's a huge reason why Russell Wilson is the guy he is today and the player that he is today, in terms of how having to deal and manage your life and the ups and downs and everything in between. And so, you know, Trevor, it's not just, hey, he's Russell Wilson's mental coach. I mean, he was the mental coach to hundreds and thousands of people and young athletes aspiring to accomplish more. And he was somebody that was able to break a lot of the stigma of making, you know, the field of, hey, you're going and seeing a sports psychologist. Like, okay, you know, that's a little strange. He made it something where it was, this is the edge. This is the edge that you can get. And in his own way, not only bettered people's individual lives as he was bettering their sports performance. And so Trevor really is truly a pioneer of the industry, and had so much impact on so many others, and incredibly selfless guy. And he'll be greatly missed. But as I said before, his legacy will live on. And anybody that wants to know more about what Trevor was about, he wrote a book. You can go look at it, go read it. For everybody that was in his circle, it's a pretty hard day today.
Well said, Jake. I don't need to add anything else. Gonna let you absolutely and fittingly have the final word there. And obviously, you know, thoughts and prayers and everything for his family. I can't imagine how they're feeling. And for people like you, his friends, people that knew him, I can't imagine. So,
yeah. Thanks.
So we have just 15 more minutes here before we get to the huddle. As a reminder, we have a short show. Dave Wyman going to join us. We've got Seahawks guests. It's going to be really fun, you guys. But before that, Jake and I are going to get back to our preview for week 2 for the Seattle Seahawks, specifically with where they need to build on performances in week 1. What needs to happen on both sides of the ball? It's coming your way next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. The Mariners have an off day today, but open a series against the Kansas City Royals tomorrow at 5:10 p.m. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. As a reminder for you guys, we got a short show today. It's a short one. The huddle starting next. Dave Wyman will join us. We're also going to have a couple Seahawks guests. So it's going to be a 2-hour preview for week 2 with the Titans. Will Disley is going to join us. Ryan Neal is going to join us. We're also going to hear Over Enemy Lines with Ben Arthur, who used to work here in Seattle. So he's got a unique take on this upcoming matchup. Very excited to speak to him. Before we get to any of that, though, we're going to have our own mini preview here, talking about how the Seahawks can build on performances from week 1, and we're looking on both sides of the ball. So let's start offensively. Jake, how did the Seahawks build on the performance they had in week 1? Where specifically can that happen?
Well, the big thing that I want to see them be able to build off that performance is to maintain balance, right? To be able to maintain balance in terms of the running game and the passing game, for them to work and complement one another, I think will be really key, and be able to show the strength of this offense. Now, the one area that I do believe that they will have more success or more opportunity to dominate the game is going to be in the passing game. So it would not surprise me in the least bit to see this offense have a big performance. Russell Wilson have a big performance through the air. He threw 4 touchdowns last week, but it was more of a efficient game where he had less attempts than they did rushing attempts.
25 or something.
So I anticipate maybe that number increasing based off of where the strengths are and where the matchups are in this game. But I do want to see them be able to maintain that offensive firepower through the passing game, yet don't forget about the running game. Don't forget about Chris Carson and keep that ground game very much involved, very much in sync with what you're doing. And that's what ended up happening last year. Oftentimes when the offense was performing at a high level, it was so heavily on the passing game, and they did not adequately keep the running game, keep Chris Carson involved to balance everything out.
All right, let's look at defensively with what they need to do. To me, the greatest weapon Tennessee has, regardless of the addition of Julio Jones, is Derrick Henry. Thankfully, the Seahawks had, one area they excelled, or at least were most consistent in defensively from start to finish, was run defense. At times they slipped, at times they struggled, but they did manage to be okay there. Last year, they allowed about 100 yards on the ground from Tennessee. A lot of that was some scrambles from Carson Wentz, though, so they overall held Jonathan Taylor on the ground. How do they try to repeat that performance?
Well, you have to do it with discipline. In these games, you have to be disciplined. You have to be able to hit your gap responsibilities on the defensive line. Bobby Wagner, Jordan Brooks, whoever's playing the nickel, Ugo Amadi, Marquise Blair, Jamal Adams. These guys need to be perfectionists with their run fits, because if you leave something open, Derrick Henry's going to make you pay. He's too big, he's too physical, and he's too good of a back with the feel that he has to not hit those mistakes. So you have to be able to do that. And if Derrick Henry's in open space, you've got to bring your pads with you. You've got to be able to wrap up, and don't let him get one of those famous famous stiff arms on you in this game. So that, to me, is really going to be the key with Derrick Henry. Collapse the pocket. Win the battle at the line of scrimmage. Win that 6-inch battle. Push them back and blow up those running schemes. And that's honestly what the Arizona Cardinals were able to do so well. Derrick Henry very, very seldomly had any actual play to go to. There was nothing really that developed well for Derrick Henry in that game for the full 60 minutes. That's what the Seahawks defensive line has to create. Because I'm with you, if Derrick Henry gets involved in this game, it becomes a ball game. It becomes a game where Tennessee is able to control time of possession. They're able to keep the ball out of this offense's hands, and it'll open everything else from a passing attack perspective. It all starts with Derrick Henry.
Who becomes maybe the most important player on defense when it comes to stopping Derrick Henry in particular? I know the easy answer. I don't want to say easy answer. I know the automatic answer is like, well, who's your middle linebacker? But, I mean, who to you becomes your most important guy?
Well, it's... I have battled back and forth with this, because you could say, well, it's the linebackers.
Right.
Oh, it's defensive line. It's the edge players. But really, to me, the two guys that need to have a monster game is going to be Puna Ford and Al Woods and Brian Monet.
Yep.
The defensive tackles,
in the middle.
They have to be able to dominate and do their job. They did it very, very well against the Colts. They've got to come up big again.
I think when I look at Jake, I'm heading back to offense for this one. Maintaining balance is important. I don't know that I looked at a particular player for the answer to this question so much as I did a statistic. I think the Seahawks were great with third down conversions in their game against Indianapolis. And meanwhile, the defense also held Indianapolis to about 38%, which is like just below what league average would be. The Titans defense allowed 54% conversion on third down and 4 of 5 touchdowns from the red zone from the Cardinals. Now, it would be a horrible outing for them to kind of repeat those numbers, because those are fantastic numbers in both categories. But it's one area where Seattle struggled. By the end of the season, even with the great start they had, averaged out and everything, even with a career high in touchdowns and all these other categories for Seattle, they still finished something like 27th. In third down conversion percentage. You started out well. I'd like to see them continue to do well there, because it's very basic and very simple, but a key to success: move the sticks.
It absolutely is. You have to be able to convert on third down. Great offenses convert on third down. Great quarterbacks convert on third down. You have to be able to beat the unique pressures that they bring, the unique coverages that they bring on third down. That is the mark of a great offense. And so you're 100% right to point to that statistic. Again, something that was drilled into me from my time when I was at BYU in the quarterback room. completions equals first downs, which equals touchdowns. You have to be able to do that all game long, be able to move the sticks. That's the name of the game at the quarterback position and offensively. And based off of what I saw from Tennessee, they're going to provide you plenty of opportunity to, once again, execute well on third down.
All right, sit back, relax, get ready for a two-hour preview of Seahawks-Titans for week 2. We're going to have Dave Wyman join us for the world-famous huddle. It starts next. Don't go anywhere.